It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out how to get started foraging for spring edibles like morels and ramps.
First, though, last month the Supreme Court decided that aggregate campaign finance limits are not constitutional on grounds of free speech. That was a case of McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission.
In the wake of that decision, donors can donate as much as they like in any given election cycle overall. However, there are still restrictions on how much donors can give to one specific candidate.
That decision was made on the federal level, but Wisconsin state-specific campaign finance limits still stood. Yesterday, Wisconsin election officials acknowledged that in light of the McCutcheon decision last month, Wisconsin's limits can't be upheld. Here with us to talk about what this could mean for Wisconsin politics is Ken Mayer. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison and an expert on campaign finance. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, so how inevitable was this moment once the Supreme Court ruled against overall campaign donation limits last month?
It was inevitable because Wisconsin has to abide by the national constitutional rulings. And once the court issued that decision in McCutcheon, it was just a matter of when officials here would acknowledge that the state limits, the aggregate limits, are similarly unconstitutional.
So was it a matter of election officials acknowledging that they had to follow these limits, or was it something that had to be brought via the court?
Well, the acknowledgement took place in the context of a lawsuit that had been filed last year by someone who had challenged the state aggregate limits. And what the GAB officials did yesterday was acknowledge in court that they would no longer be able to uphold or enforce those limits. So it was kind of an odd process in the sense that it wasn't the legislature, it wasn't a formal rulemaking process. It was just an acknowledgement that the state of the world had changed and they couldn't enforce them anymore.
Now, Wisconsin isn't the only state that had these limits. There are others out there. What are we seeing elsewhere in the nation about what's happening in the light of this ruling?
They'll fall everywhere. Now that we have this constitutional ruling from the Supreme Court, there is no state that will be able to enforce these aggregate limits. Now, there are also some states that don't have aggregate limits or that have much looser regulations. They won't be affected.
Now, Fred Young Jr. was the one involved in this case that we're talking about, and it hasn't been settled yet, but can you talk about what that case was and what's at stake there specifically?
Well, as I understand it, it was similar to what McCutcheon was arguing at the federal level. It was a lawsuit that was alleging that the aggregate caps, which in Wisconsin were actually much stricter than at the federal level, there was a $10,000 limit here as opposed to what amounted to about a $45,000 limit to federal candidates from individuals. So it was parallel litigation, and it was just a matter of time once the McCutcheon decision came down.
Now, Fred Young Jr. has said he sees a more educated, a more engaged electorate coming from this decision. What do opponents see?
Well, if you talk to campaign reform groups like the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, they see this as just another way for wealthy people to have disproportionate influence in elections. And so you balance the individual right to be able to contribute. There's a First Amendment right at stake there versus a general concern about the nature of influence and corruption. Now, where it gets a little difficult is that the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has consistently held that influence, or a concern that certain groups or certain people will have too much influence, is not a consideration. That the only justification for these kinds of limits is preventing, as they put it, corruption or the appearance of corruption. And so, when you think about it in terms of certain groups having more or less influence, there are arguments that you can make about the consequences, but as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, those don't carry any weight.
How do you see this affecting donations to specific parties, aka the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, or political action committees?
Well, what's going to happen is you will see a relatively small number of people make more individual contributions to candidates. And it's worth stressing that those contribution limits, which are $500 for state assembly, $1,000 for a Senate state senator, and up to $10,000 for statewide candidates, those contribution limits remain in force. But now an individual will be free to give as many of those contributions to as many different candidates as they like.
And do you see that as being something that's going to affect a large proportion of candidates, for example, or is it going to be relatively small group of people we're talking about?
Oh, it certainly will be a small number of people who make the contributions. I actually don't think it's going to have a dramatic effect on candidates or elections here, because there were already so many ways for groups and political parties and other types of associations to spend what amounted to unlimited amounts of money on independent expenditures. And those gates had been opened through previous Supreme Court decisions. And so, if anything, it's possible to think about a positive effect of this is that there will be presumably more money coming into candidates where there's better disclosure, better ability to track those contributions. But the overall, if this has any effect, it will continue to increase the amount of money that is given to candidates.
Now, some critics here in Wisconsin have said that this could amount to money laundering, that you hit your limit for a particular candidate and then you give to a group and then they just funnel it back toward that candidate. Do you see that happening?
Well, there will probably be some things that look like that. Wisconsin law parallels fairly closely with the federal law in that regard, that you are not allowed to give money to a political committee or a political action committee with the expectation or understanding that they will turn around and give that money to an individual candidate. Now, the concern among campaign finance reform groups is that it's possible to communicate that or have that kind of understanding without anything being explicit. We'll see. I think there will be some concern about those sorts of things happening. But again, in many ways, this horse has already left the barn, that you can give $10,000 to Scott Walker or to Mary Burke and turn around and give an unlimited amount of money, millions of dollars, to a group, an outside group that is making independent expenditures on that election.
Do you think limits will remain on how much can be given to individual candidates here in Wisconsin?
Well, that's the big concern, that it's one of the last bulwarks of the original campaign finance regulation that extends back to the 1970s. So far, there are no indications that the Supreme Court is ready to explicitly consider that. But there are some indications, if you parse the language of McCutcheon carefully, there are some indications that they might be willing to entertain that, because if you consider the problem as one of solely corruption, the court seems to be open to an argument that a $2,000 or $2,500 or $2,600 contribution, if that's not corrupting, then why not $3,000 or $4,000 and $5,000? One thing that I think is very likely is that we will see somebody mount a challenge to that aspect of the law fairly soon. And whether or not it gets to the Supreme Court and is successful is obviously a different question. But I think we will see that coming down the pike at some point.
And what will this change mean, do you think, for the issue of transparency in political spending here in Wisconsin?
Well, there are already plenty of opportunities for people to obscure where the money is coming from. There are already lots of issues about groups that organize as tax-exempt groups, 501c3s and c4s, and their disclosure is different than it is for committees that are explicitly engaging in election express advocacy, independent expenditures. It's going to continue to be difficult. I think what will happen is we will see somewhat more money coming into candidates, but I really don't think it's going to diminish the amount that's going into these outside independent groups, in part because if you do that, it's somewhat easier to obscure where the money is ultimately coming from.
So how soon do you expect this to be in effect, the caps to be off in Wisconsin?
I would suspect that they'll be not enforced effective immediately, although it may be some time before it officially comes down as a formal rule. But I would imagine that as far as the GAB is concerned, that they are no longer in effect as of now.
As of now. All right, Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
We've been talking to Ken Mayer, political science professor at UW-Madison and an expert on campaign finance reform. Yesterday, Wisconsin election officials acknowledged that the state's aggregate campaign donations couldn't be upheld in light of the Supreme Court's decision along the same lines last month.
Coming up, we get a lesson in foraging 101 from a master forager who will tell us how to find ramps, morels, and other tasty offerings from Mother Nature.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. The growing season is finally starting to pick up some steam around here, but some of the yummiest foods out there aren't growing in neat rows in your garden. Sometimes all you have to do is forage in the wild to find spring ingredients like ramps, morels, and watercress.
Here to give us a lesson in foraging 101 is our regular food fanatic, Ian Knauer. Ian's the host of the PBS show The Farm and the author of a cookbook by the same name. He's also a farm-to-table chef who grows his own food on the family land in Pennsylvania. Ian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So, you know, we could be hitting the farmer's market and buying things, I guess, like ramps and morels and watercress, but you like to do it another way. You forage. What exactly do we mean when we talk about foraging?
Well, we basically mean that you wander through the woods looking for all these delicious things that grow wild in nature, and you're smart enough or educated enough to know which are the good ones and which are the not good ones, and then you can take those home and cook them up. In fact, ramps are a really good example. At my local farmer's market, I saw them last weekend for $30 a pound, which is really expensive. And they grow just about everywhere, all over the country, really, and they're free.
What about the state of foraging these days? You know, back in the 70s and 80s, there was some popular commercials and people sort of made fun of it in a fashion. But now it seems as though it's a serious pursuit and it seems as though more people are taking advantage of this.
Well, I think that stems from the real interest in the culture of food in this country, in American food culture. This is just a natural extension of that. You know, we're looking to artists and producers to make our bacons and our jellies and our jams. And we're looking to nature and everything that it supplies just, you know, in the wild. And you're right. It is. It used to be sort of this crazy thing that only wild people did. But now it's become really popular. And I think that's great.
So do we need special equipment to go out there foraging? What do we need when we're suiting up?
Well, the first thing that you want to keep in mind is that you will be walking through the woods. And all sorts of plants are starting to pop up this time of year, including poison ivy. So I would wear long pants and long socks and boots if you have them. Another thing to think about is that the ticks are starting to wake up, so put on some bug spray. And that way you're protected against the very common natural predators that are out there looking to eat you instead of you eating them.
So then once you're all dressed up, you're lubed up, you've got your tick protection on, you're out in the woods, how do you sort of train your eyes to look for what you need to find? Because, you know, if you're not used to this, you go out there and it's just a bunch of green stuff.
That's right. The first thing you want to do is you want to know what you're looking for. So there are some really great books out there on foraging. One just came out last year. It's called Foraged Flavor. It's written by a woman named Tama Wong. And she's actually a pretty famous forager. She supplies restaurants like Danielle in New York City with their wild greens. And she wrote this really wonderful book. It's very simple to follow. It's got great pictures, so you can, you know, take it with you and compare with what you find. But there are a lot of books out there. So I would start by finding out what it is that you want to look for and what it looks like. And then you want to figure out where those things grow. And, of course, what time of year they grow. So now, of course, we're in watercress season and ramp season and morel season. And some of those things have lookalikes that aren't quite the real thing. Like morels, there's such a thing as a false morel. Ramps have actually a poisonous lookalike. Lily of the Valley looks a little bit like ramps. So you want to be able to look for the telltale signs that tell you just what the real thing is. And, of course, with ramps, it's pretty easy because they smell like onions. You know, you break them up and you sniff them, and it's pretty obvious that you found them when you found them. Morels are very pine cone in shape, and the false morels look sort of like a gnarly fist. So that's what you're looking for. Both those things are a very basic level of forager. You don't need to be, you don't have to have a master's degree in foraging to do pretty well with those two. And watercress is also quite easy to spot because it grows in water. So if you find a creek and it has some slow-moving water in it, that's where you would want to look for the watercress.
Well, I would be in heaven if I could find morels. You said there's this false morel to look out for. I think you said the false one looks like the gnarly fist?
That's correct, yeah. So the real one looks like this. Looks just like a morel. It's just this perfect little pine cone on top of a little hollow stem. Now, they grow singularly, which means there's one growing in each space, not two or three. They're not in clumps like some mushrooms. They grow on the forest floor, not on wood. But they also grow close to, and they really like, tulip poplar trees. Now, tulip poplars are easy to spot in the woods because they're very tall and they're very straight. So if you find yourself a cluster of tulip poplars, start looking around the base of those trees and nearby those trees for morels. I also find that it's actually much easier to spot them if you get down on your hands and knees and look horizontally, because then you'll see them, you know, a little forest of morels. And if you're looking down, they're really good at camouflaging. You know, it's funny. Mushroom foragers say that you forage for mushrooms, but you hunt for morels. They're a little bit harder to find, but once you find them, they're easy to identify.
But if you're rolling around on the forest floor, you're down there with the ticks and the poison ivy.
That's why you wear long clothing. And,
I guess so.
And put your bug spray on.
So this year here in Wisconsin, it's been pretty cool and kind of wet in the last couple of weeks. And how does the and I think our season here is behind in terms of where we might be for a normal year. How does that affect things like ramps and some of the other things we're talking about? Obviously, they're affected by the weather and by the seasons.
Of course, yeah. Wild crops are just as influenced by the climate as cultivated crops. So if you're a little cooler and you've had some rain, the rain is actually really good for all these things. And the cooler weather will slow it down a little bit. So as soon as you start to get some warmer days, that's when you want to start looking for this stuff. The ramps will they'll be slow if it's cool, slow to grow if it's cool. And the morels just won't appear until it just gets a little warmer. You're looking for, you know, daytime temperatures in the high 50s, low 60s.
So let's say we find what we're looking for. We find our ramps. We find our morels. What do we need to know about how to pick it and then to store it so that it's, you know, still in good shape when we get it home to cook with it?
So each one of these has its own little quirks and characteristics. The watercress, for instance, I like to clip off the top of it, leaving the roots in the water and in the mud, and then put that in a plastic bag with a little bit of the water from the creek. That keeps it very crisp and fresh, and you know you have no chance of it spoiling on your trip home. The ramps, the best way to cut the ramps is to dig down maybe an inch or so, and then cut them with a pair of kitchen shears. Now you want to be careful not to take the rhizome, the root rhizome, with you because that's what brings the next year's ramp crop back. And so you'll have the green leaves and part of the stalk for the ramps. We'll come back to that in just a second because I want to tell you more about the rhizome. But the ramps, you can put just put them in a plastic bag. And then the morels, you want to cut them off where they meet the ground. And for mushrooms, you want to put them in a paper bag because they like to breathe a little bit. So that's how you would want to harvest them and get them home. But going back to those ramp rhizomes, if you ever see ramps at the farmer's market, and they have some root on them, buy them and then take those roots, cut off the roots, use the rest of the ramp to cook with, and plant those roots because that rhizome will continue to produce ramps. And so you can then find a nice shaded place in the forest. They like to be near hardwood trees like oak trees and plant them near the base of a hardwood tree. And there's a pretty good chance if the conditions are right that they'll come back year after year for you.
So you can actually grow your own ramps, kind of cultivate them. That's cool.
Yeah, and it's sort of a myth that you can't cultivate them. You definitely can. I have for several years now.
And so, Ian, in our last minute here, I know you've got a special place in your heart for ramps, and you've included a ramp recipe for us to try out. What do you love about ramps, and what is in your ramp recipe?
Well, the thing that I love about ramps is not the fact that you can only get them for a few weeks a year. I wish that we could get them all year long. But it's the fact that they have a very unique onion flavor. They're not like an onion, they're not like a leek, they're not like a garlic. There's some combination of those three things And they also have a real beautiful sweetness to them that comes out when you cook the leaves. So flavor-wise, I think they're probably one of my favorite flavors in the onion family. And cooking them, you can cook them like you would use anything from a scallion to an onion to garlic to leeks. You can roast them, you can saute them, you can puree them. And they really give a beautiful, gentle, oniony sweetness to whatever you put them in.
And we've got your recipe for ramp pasta with some cream and lots of other luscious stuff up on our Facebook page. Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure to talk to you guys.
That was Ian Knauer, host of the PBS show The Farm and the author of a cookbook by the same name.
And don't forget, you can check out his wild ramp pasta recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking to a cardiologist about a surprising phenomenon known as the obesity paradox. He says the science of obesity shows heavier people may actually be healthier than thinner people.
Our guest is Dr. Carl Levee, a cardiologist at the John Ochsner Heart and Vascular Institute in New Orleans, and he is the author of the book we'll be discussing, The Obesity Paradox, When Thinner Means Sicker and Heavier Means Healthier. Dr. Levee, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you this afternoon.
I want to talk a little bit about how we look at body types in society today. And you talk a little bit about some of that history in your book, particularly with regards to being heavier, being obese. But as we sit here today in 2014, I think it's fair to say the general wisdom is that if you're obese, and pretty much at any level in some cases, that you're unhealthy. And if you're thin, magically somehow that makes you healthy.
I think that's been a perception that's not totally accurate. And my colleagues and I during the past 10 to 15 years, I think, have been involved with a lot of groundbreaking research that in a way is quite controversial, was initially surprising to me as a doctor, and in some ways has really changed conventional wisdom or turned it on its head. I think our research really makes the point that you cannot no longer say what many doctors and what many people have thought for a long time, that thinner is necessarily healthier.
And I want to talk about kind of how you developed your interest in it, because you talk at one point early in the book, and you've got a chapter devoted to it, but the big fat conundrum. And you said that you noticed that there were people who were over or moderately obese, and they had a form of cardiovascular disease. And yet, if they had that cardiovascular disease, their prognosis for where they were going to wind up often turned out to be better than some of their thinner counterparts. When did you first start to notice that? And when you started to notice it, it must have raised eyebrows.
Yes, in fact, when I first started to notice it in the early 2000s, and we were doing a study of measuring what's called a cardiopulmonary stress test, measuring oxygen consumption for patients with advanced heart failure, very weakened heart muscle, and we thought that if we corrected the oxygen consumption for lean body mass, we would get a more accurate prediction of prognosis, and we turned out we were correct. But in the process of being able to get the lean body mass, we had to get percent body fat. And when we did that study, we initially saw that the heart failure patients who died had a lower BMI, which is the standard way you define obesity, just a height weight measurement, but they also had a lower percent body fat. And when I first saw those results, my first thought was that we had mixed up the numbers. You know, that we had reversed the deaths and the survivors, and we had it backwards. And we were able to quickly verify that. And then we went over the data very carefully to see is there some mistake here. And we actually found in subsequent papers that were initially hard to get published in the major cardiovascular literature, that we found that in these heart failure patients, for every 1% increase in body fat, there was a 13% reduction in mortality. So we found that the heavier people with advanced heart failure were surviving more. And that was a quite remarkable finding, because we knew that people with very significant obesity develop heart failure more commonly than thinner people. And in fact, you know, we know that at least significant overweightness and obesity adversely affects most of our cardiovascular risk factors. It raises the blood pressure. It raises blood sugars. It adversely affects the blood lipids, the fats in the blood. It increases inflammation. And so people who are heavier get more heart disease. They get more hypertension. They get more coronary artery disease, heart failure, more rhythm disturbances like atrial fibrillation. But now, winding forward from our initial findings in the early 2000s to 2014, numerous studies and large meta-analyses, which means putting together the results of many studies into one large report, have shown that the overweight and obese with these heart diseases, you know, hypertension, coronary disease, heart failure, atrial fibrillation, to name four, that the overweight and obese are actually doing better and sometimes have 30 to 50% lower mortality rates than do the same do the patients with the same heart diseases who are in the normal weight range. So that's really the obesity paradox, at least in cardiovascular disease, in a nutshell.
And it raises all sorts of questions, but I think one of the biggest questions it sort of raises, at least in my mind, is this whole idea of what good health looks like. Because, you know, I think that, as you said earlier, there's that perception you can look at somebody and sort of tell. But the numbers aren't telling that story. At the same time, we hear all the stories about, you know, the obesity epidemic, and Americans are sitting on the couch watching television and all that sort of thing. And there are a lot of mixed messages out there. How do you sort all of that stuff out?
Yeah, and absolutely. And I'd like to say from the outset for the folks listening that my book, The Obesity Paradox, does not try to promote obesity. And I'm never suggesting that people who are normal weight try to gain weight to become overweight or obese. But my book points out a number of fallacies that I think people have developed over many decades of thinking that fat is the devil. I mean, fat has been demonized by our society, and that's not always the case. In fact, our research shows that low fitness is a much bigger threat to health that usually comes from low physical activity than is fatness, if one's main goal is to live a long and healthy life. And I like to just talk about a big study that came out in January of 2013. It's by Catherine Flegel of the Center of Disease Control. It was published in JAMA, which is, along with New England Journal of Medicine, our leading medical journal in the United States, Journal of American Medical Association. It came out in January 2013. It was a meta-analysis of 97 studies of 2.9 million people. And that study showed that the optimal survival was in a BMI of 25 to 30. That's a BMI range that's considered in the overweight range. And they had a 6% lower mortality than did the normal BMI, which is between 18.5 and 25. And it was statistically significant. And the mildly obese, which is a BMI, also called class 1 obesity, is a BMI between 30 and 35, they actually had a 5% lower mortality than did the normal weight, although it was not quite statistically significant. Now, when you looked at all the obese combined had a significantly higher mortality than did the normal weight, but that's because there was a considerably higher mortality in the higher degrees of obesity, the class 2 obesity between 35 and 40, and especially the above 40, which is called class 3 obesity, or a lot of times that's defined as morbid obesity. I think that's kind of a mean term. I'd rather, you know, I think that I think calling it class 3 obesity sounds better. But most of the increased mortality is coming from the more severe degrees of obesity, not the overweight and the mild obesity. And clearly, the severe obesity, like a BMI above 40, or what some clinicians and scientists and some patients refer to as morbid obesity, is present in 3% of our population now. In our population in the United States, the current statistics are 74% meet criteria by the BMI for being overweight or obese, and 35% meet the criteria for being obese. So it's a large number of patients, but only 3% right now. But that, unfortunately, that number is growing, or meeting the criteria for class 3 obesity with a BMI of 40. And that degree of obesity is clearly associated with adverse health outcomes. My book, The Obesity Paradox, really does not pertain to the very severe degrees of obesity where clearly weight loss is needed, and whether that weight loss with vigorous diet, non-pharmacologic therapies, even potentially drug therapies, maybe bariatric surgery to reduce obesity. But in the milder degrees of obesity, or even overweight or the class 1 obesity between 30 and 35, there's actually very little evidence that weight loss improves major health outcomes. And in fact, in those patients, there's a lot more evidence that increasing fitness, or at least avoiding low fitness, is much better for protecting against adverse health outcomes than is weight loss.
Okay, that's a good place to leave it for the moment. We're talking with Dr. Carl Levie, a cardiologist and the author of The Obesity Paradox, about how heavier people may actually be healthier than some thinner people.
And we want to hear from you on this one. What do you think about this idea of the obesity paradox? Is this something you've encountered in your life? And what do you consider healthy? Does this make sense to you that in some cases it can be true that being a little heavier is a little healthier? Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send email to talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation now with Dr. Carl Levie, cardiologist and the author of The Obesity Paradox, When Thinner Means Sicker and Heavier Means Healthier.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. So what do you think about this idea of the obesity paradox? Is this something you've encountered in your own life? What do you consider to be healthy weight? And what level does fitness play in all of that? Give us a call. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email, talk@WPR.org. Dr. Levie, right before the break, you mentioned that idea of fitness, and you spend a considerable amount of time on that in your book. And when people think about losing weight, they think about fitness and diet. And of those two, which do you consider to be more important, or are they about the same?
I think actually becoming... And just for example, when you see some thin people, I think very often over the years, people have assumed that they're healthier. And the fact is, though, a lot of thin people can have very little muscle mass, can have low physical.
And we are having mildly obese. There he is. I'm sorry, doctor, your line has been going in and out.
Oh, sorry.
And so people missed a little bit of that.
Okay.
And so, but you were basically saying that idea that sometimes being thin, they may have low muscle mass, they may have some other health issues that may not be apparent to people who are just looking at them.
That's correct. And actually, very often, they may not be fit.
And we're...
Who's fit has actually a much better prognosis than does a thin person who's has a low level of fitness. So fitness is more important than fatness for predicting long-term good health.
Let's go to the listeners right now. We've got some who would like to join in the discussion, and we begin with Bill, who joins us from Greendale. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Great show. The guest, you're saying that just because I'm overweight doesn't mean I'm more at risk for cardiovascular disease. And I have a question for you. Lately, I've been telling people, because I am thin, I've been telling people just because I'm thin doesn't mean I'm at risk, because it could be, if I'm on a low-fat diet, I'm eating a lot of, typically, if I'm shopping in a regular grocery store, I'm eating a lot of high sugar or high carbohydrate replacements for that fat. And I think that because the sugars turn into fat because it raises the insulin and the fat goes on the liver, as I understand it, that actually I could be more at risk for cardiovascular and a whole line of diseases on that set. So I'm kind of taking it from the diet perspective a little bit,
yeah.
And I agree with what you're saying. It's fascinating stuff.
Bill, thanks for the call, doctor. Obviously, Bill's been thinking about this quite a bit. Does everybody think about it to the extent that Bill does, or we take a more surface-oriented approach?
Well, I certainly would think the majority of people don't think of that type of detail, but there are a lot of people that have focused a lot of attention about the relative perils of sugar and carbohydrate in our society. And in fact, in a lot of ways, the sugar industry has been attacked, and in some situations it's being attacked almost like the tobacco industry has been attacked, and I think that's right now without merit. I think that some people believe that all of obesity or a great amount of obesity is coming because of too much sugar and too much carbohydrate. My colleagues and I have published some big studies over the last several years that I think point out that the fundamental cause of the progressive obesity that has occurred in our society is the very marked declines that have occurred during the last five decades in physical activity. Now, many of those declines are expected. I mean, you know, 50 years ago, people had to work hard for their food. They had to work hard for many things they did, housework, yard work. Now, people can get by with because of industrialization, with very significant declines in physical activity. So they depend on the leisure time physical activity, which is formal exercise programs. So you have to make yourself exercise, whereas you were naturally exercising many decades ago. But the marked decline in physical activity is really what has caused the weight gain and obesity, not the sugar, the carbohydrate, or the increased calorie load. Now, saying that, in people who are very physically inactive, and right now the stats are only about 20% of our population are meeting the minimal criteria for physical activity. And those people who are physically inactive, they have to cut all calories, including sugar, to make up for the low physical activity. But the answer would be that if they could increase their physical activity a lot, then if one is very physically active, it would be all right to be having some sugar and some carbohydrate, and it wouldn't be so detrimental to your health. So I think the cause of obesity, even though it is multifactorial, I think that the fundamental cause is the very significant decline in physical activity.
Kay is with us now, and Kay joins us from Madison. Hi, Kay.
Hello.
You're on the
air. Hi, Kay.
Hello. Yes. Thank you for answering my call. Yeah, I just have a question about the whole reliance on BMI, because I don't know if this has been addressed earlier or not, but I know myself, I've always had a higher BMI, but I have a very low body fat percentage. I'm just naturally muscular, and when I do tend to work out or whatnot, I gain more muscle mass. And I've noticed that with other fit people, too. They're considered obese or overweight. However, they're not, you know, nowhere near that. And so I'm just wondering if that, you know, kind of, you know, attributes to that equation that you were mentioning before about how people with a little higher BMIs tend to be are not, you know, unhealthy. Maybe it's just because of the whole muscle percentage thing.
Okay, thanks for the call. Yeah. And doctor, you spend a considerable amount of time talking about BMI in your book.
Yes, and well, first of all, in a big population, typically as the BMI goes up, the body fat, you know, goes up. And so most people who, say, for example, in our society have a 33, a 35 BMI, are generally going to have a lot of fat. But very clearly, there are exceptions to the rule on both ends. And I'll give a big exception. The middle linebackers in the NFL, many of them would have a BMI, would be classified as obese, and they're solid muscle, you know, and they have hardly any fat on them. And vice versa, you can have some people with normal BMIs who have very little muscle, and they pretty much all fat. And so BMI in individuals is certainly not perfect. And we probably, you know, probably the ideal way to assess, body composition in a research study would be to have scans of what's called DEXA scans. That's not practical in the population. And then so you can do things like waist circumference, waist to hip ratio. You can do some simple body fat determinations. By many of my studies, we just used the sum of the skin fold method, but that really assesses subcutaneous fat, not visceral fat. But very clearly, a lot of times you can look at someone and see that they have a lot more muscle. And so in individuals, two people that have the same exact BMI, one may have a lot of muscle and one may have very little muscle. And so that's why BMI in individuals can be misleading. And certainly in general, when people gain weight, they gain usually a lot of fat unless they do an exercise to make more of the weight gain in muscle. But even when you gain fat, you're going to be gaining usually some muscle. And so a lot of times the heavier people can have more muscle mass than some of the real thin people, particularly the real thin people who are very physically inactive and again, a lot of times can have very low muscle mass. And they can have low levels of fitness. And like I said before, many of those individuals have a much higher risk than do heavier people who have more muscle mass, and especially heavier people who have more muscle mass who are physically fit. They can have a much better prognosis than a thinner person. So you really can't just look at the weight. I think that the weight itself has been tremendously overemphasized in our society, and so you can't just go by what the scale says and determine your health.
Yeah, we've only got less than a minute left, and at the end of your book, you have the 10 principles for readers to take into account about health, and you talk about the putting obesity into a personal perspective as principle number one.
Yes, I think I said at the beginning that my book does not promote obesity, and I'm not trying to get people to gain weight. But you can't just say that a person who's got more weight on them or who's not at their ideal body weight is unhealthy. And really, you can get a lot more information about health from metabolic health, you know, looking at their sugar, their blood pressure, their lipids, their level of inflammation, their C-reactive protein, and particularly knowing about their fitness. And you know, in research studies, we can measure fitness on the treadmill, but in practice, a lot of times, you don't have a treadmill test. All people in society don't have a treadmill test.
And that's where I'm afraid we'll have to leave it. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Levy.
Okay, Gene, I enjoyed talking with you today.
That was Dr. Carl Levy, cardiologist and the author of The Obesity Paradox, When Thinner Means Sicker and Heavier Means Healthier. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.